everybody, and welcome back to the Shelfware Podcast. I'm Scott, and today we're going to talk about The Woman in the Dunes, which is a novel by Kobo Abe from 1962. And to help me talk about this is Rose. Hello, Rose.
Hello.
And welcome.
Thank you.
You have a couple of podcasts of your own that you do with your sister, right?
Yes.
One is An American's Guide to Bollywood, which is fun as heck. And then More is More. So tell me, what are you doing in The American's Guide to Bollywood?
So we just kind of review Bollywood movies, but from the perspective of maybe people who haven't seen a lot of Bollywood. So an American's perspective and what an American might think of it, because a lot of the times all you can find are what Indians think about it, which doesn't mean as much as you might think. Turns out we have super different tastes.
Yes, yes.
And then,
cool.
Yeah, and then More is More is us talking about a bad movie, just going through a bad movie and talking about it.
Right. And those are a hoot. They're both a hoot. I enjoy them both, but More is More makes me laugh a lot. You guys do a great job.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So you're the one who suggested this book, The Woman in the Dunes by Kobo Abe. So how did you come across this one?
Well, I actually saw the movie before I read the book. I saw the movie in college, and it was just really weird, but like kind of mesmerizing.
Mm-hmm.
So I wound up reading the book, which was just as weird and mesmerizing in a different way, since you get more of his internal stuff than you can in a movie.
I agree with that. I read the book. When I type in Woman in the Dunes on the internet, I get as many movie references as book ones.
Yeah.
But it is kind of equal. So I watched the movie after reading the book, and I wonder how different that experience was. But the movie's amazing.
Yeah. It's done by a really well-respected director, Hiroshi Teshigahara. Gosh, that is a mouthful. He's only really done a few movies that anyone's heard of, but this is probably his most famous one, Woman in the Dunes. And he did it with Kobo Abe writing the screenplay. So I think it's pretty faithful to the novel. But because the novel is such an internal story, there's so much of the man's thoughts. I think it was probably really challenging to do. And so he expresses it a lot with kind of surrealist images and through the sound design of the environment that they're in.
Yeah. And I thought he pulled that off really well. It's not a book I would read and say, hey, this ought to be a movie. it's not unlike, you know, Arrival, Arrival, and it's based on Story of Your Life by Ted Chiang. I would never have thought that could be a really good movie.
And
it's kind of the same here, because everything is, like you said, it's all internal, but then there's so much description about bodies as well. I don't know if you felt that it was like visceral. There was this whole physical existence thing going on that I didn't know that they could do in film. And yet I feel like he pulled it off. You know, you could feel the sand and you could feel the thirst even in the movie.
Yeah. And I think that's really his skill as a director. I'm really impressed that he was able to do it.
Yeah, me too. Me too. So, wow. So what is this novel? How would you describe this to somebody?
Yeah, it's about this guy who he's an amateur entomologist, a Japanese amateur entomologist, who goes on vacation to look for bugs in a sandy area and winds up getting trapped by the villagers into living in a sand pit with a woman whose husband and children have died, so she's all by herself. And their entire existence is predicated around just shoveling sand out of their pit so that it doesn't collapse the house.
Yeah, and I mean, that's the description. So the whole thing, you know, at the beginning, he's out there looking for bugs. And as he approaches the ocean, the sand dunes are getting taller, when he would think it would slope down toward the ocean. This is what I'm getting from it, right? And then eventually the sand is higher than the houses. And you get this, it's almost like suddenly he's in this almost fantasy land. That this is what was going through my head. And he's looking down at houses that are in pits. You know, so it's like this sand dune has gone over the houses that existed there, but they kept the houses clear so that now these houses are like in a pit. And, and the people that live in there, he didn't know at the time, but he learned later, just constantly dig to make sure that their house never gets covered.
Yeah. I mean, an insane setup.
Insane. For a book. Yeah. Yeah. So when after I finished it, I asked you, I said, would you call this surreal? And you used the word surreal, you know, is it surreal? And, on Wikipedia, you know, he's being compared to Franz Kafka. He being Kobo Abe, the author, Franz Kafka. They say modernist. They use the word surreal, and they use the word absurdist. When they're absurdist talking about
is probably
him.
A good one too. Yeah, I've only read this book by him, so I don't know overall like if he kind of is existentialist the way Kafka is. I think his setup feels Kafka-esque, but I don't know if overall what he tries to say in books is the same as him, because this is a book that's so open to interpretation. Like, it's so vague on the specifics that you can interpret it in a lot of different ways. And I think existential is only one of them.
Yeah, there is a lot here. No question. I mean, just, you know, I could tell that this is a book I'm going to reread. Which is a sign of a good book, in my opinion. But it's definitely something that I was like, man, I'm going to be able to get more out of this if I keep reading it. And that's the basic thing. And I would highly recommend it. And you clearly would recommend it because you brought it here. So, so before we get into some details, if folks want to read it and not be spoiled, now's the time to go ahead and jump off and do that. I was thoroughly impressed by it, and I'm glad that I read it. I felt it was another word that I would use for it is bleak. I felt like it was bleak. It is not a happy book.
No, it's not something you read just because you're looking for something to read on vacation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
It's a real thinker.
It is a real thinker for sure. For sure.
Kind of an unpleasant book in some ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so the first thing that leapt out at me was, okay, what is the significance of him being an entomologist? I felt like that was important from the get-go, and it was interesting. It's like he lives in an anthill now, you know. Once they put him in the pit, it's like he's an insect being observed by these townspeople. Who I never quite understood their motivation, you know. She said at one time that she's selling the sand, but I don't know that motivation is what he's going for here. He's again, this is like a surreal thing, so there are going to be some things that just aren't going to make logical sense. But the fact that he's at the beginning, you know, looking for and capturing insects, and then he's caught just like one. That was kind of amazing.
Yeah, it feels like a real ant farm vibe. And I think him talking about insects that have evolved to live in the sand and inhospitable areas, and that even in inhospitable areas where you wouldn't think life could exist, life will thrive in these insects and plants that have evolved there.
Yeah, and he's in a sand pit, and he eventually thrives, I guess. I don't know if you'd call it thriving. He's living.
Yeah, he certainly exists, probably much like an insect does. I mean, he does what to our minds is a really pointless task every day, and then just kind of lives in the periphery of that.
Right, and that's what insects do.
Yeah.
You watch an anthill, they're just constantly just carrying stuff around or bringing food down, you know? Yeah, yeah, I thought that was something. And it is nightmarish. I mean, it's almost like, I don't know, like the fly, you know, the old thing, you know, it's like you turn into a fly. But I don't know, maybe that's why they're comparing him to Kafka or something like that, because, I mean, they're not physically turning into that, but it's just this weird, like, you know, I'm on a board with a pin stuck in me and people are watching me. kind of a thing to it. It was a nightmare.
Yeah, and the descriptions really add to that. I mean, it feels really claustrophobic just reading it.
Big time, big time. Well, one thing that I found interesting because I watched the movie second was mm-hmm. how close they were to what I was seeing in my head from the book. Because there were times where I'm like, okay, what? How exactly is this? You know? And you say claustrophobic. So for me, I think a difference between an image from the movie is that I felt like the walls of the pit were closer to the house even. It was like I was imagining a house that you could, you know, barely walk around, you know?
Yeah. That's imminent danger of collapse. Right.
That's how it was in my head. But other than that, it was pretty much the same.
So yeah.
Yeah. But claustrophobic is an excellent word for that. You know, and then they'd be in the house and they'd hear or feel, right, sand fall down on them.
Yeah, that if they stopped even for a little while, the sand would just build up again.
And the sand itself is like, I don't know, the third character? You know, so
yeah, because he's obsessed with sand in the beginning. He's telling us all about it.
Yeah, and so I highlighted, it says, as long as the winds blew, the rivers flowed, and the seas stirred, sand would be born grain by grain from the earth, and like a living being, it would creep everywhere. The sands never rested. Gently but surely, they invaded and destroyed the surface of the earth. You know, and that's like page 17. So, yeah. You know, so he's... You know, this is before he's surrounded and dealing with sand like that all the time.
Yeah, and I had a different thing marked, which was when he's talking to the woman about it. And he says it absolutely never stops anywhere. Whether in water or air, it moves free and unrestricted. And that's what you were talking about in the beginning, where the dunes are sloping up instead of down, because they've created this artificial construct to try and stop the sand, which they can't, of course. It's just a matter of time before the whole thing collapses.
Yeah, yeah. And he's got this rational thing going on too, doesn't he? I mean, he's talking about the sand like this. And I remember a scene from the movie that I can't recall if it's in the book, although I thought they were very close. But when he told the woman, hey, we're doing this every day, but why don't they just put fences up? You know, I mean, he just is like, I can solve this. You know, why we don't need to do this. I can solve it, right? And that's been his attitude through a lot of it.
And I love what she says. She says, well, it's cheaper this way.
Yeah, it's cheaper, right? They did a study or something, she said.
Yeah, there's no thought given to the lives of the humans. It's just, this is cheaper.
Right, right. And that opens up a whole other door as to what this is about. You know,
yeah.
This whole Sisyphus economic thing where... You know, we're pushing the boulder up the hill every day for 8 hours or more every day, and then going home and then just doing it again every day, every day, every day.
Yeah, I mean, because they're living in insane conditions, of course, but they and the village that's above them are living in such extreme poverty, and yet very few people, I should say, leave. They talk about some people going to the cities where the jobs are, but they almost resent the people that have left. As though they're failing in their duty toward the town, even though the town, by its very nature, is going to be destroyed and probably should be destroyed because it's not worth keeping around.
Wow, that's interesting. I remember she said something like, aren't the city girls prettier or something? That is feeding into what you're saying, that she was resenting of the cities.
Yeah.
So they felt more free in a town where they didn't have the pressures of the city?
Well, they have a... Yeah, and they have an expression, they're like, the saying of our town is love your home.
Yeah.
So there's almost this idea that it's just because we were born here, we have to stay here. Or possibly their own apathy means that they just never leave. They just keep going in this unsustainable way.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But what's funny is that he comes from the city, and his life really wasn't that much better in a lot of ways.
Do you think that's what he realizes at the end?
Yeah, I don't. The ending is interesting. Mm-hmm. That he chooses to go back even when he can escape.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like he finds some sort of meaning in the pit that he didn't find in the city. And this is, so there's this thing at the beginning, which is kind of really ambiguous. It says, without the threat of punishment, there is no joy in flight. Did you see that?
Yes, right.
And so reading that, in the end, you kind of think, well, maybe this is his joy in flight, is discovering this way of collecting water in the sand. But I mean, to stay, like, I guess it's almost just like he's just become accustomed to it.
Yeah. And that was my first reaction, was, you know, just getting used to the prison. But I feel like he actually did find that his life here was not worse than his life there.
Yeah, because he hates his job as a teacher.
Yeah, and that's true, too. I hadn't thought of that aspect of it, because he did say something about how teachers stay, right? The pupils come in and out, and the way that he put that was also visceral. I highlighted that. I thought, yeah, here it is. So it says, "Rarely will you meet anyone so jealous as a teacher. Year after year, students tumble along like the waters of a river. They flow away, and only the teacher is left behind, like some deeply buried rock at the bottom of the current." It's like, wow, you know, so that's the way he's looking at himself.
You know, it's funny, I didn't think about it, but that's almost like the students are the sand and the teachers are the ones living in the pit.
Oh, wow. Yeah, right. They flow away, right?
Yeah.
Very much so. Yeah, it's definitely comparing those two. And that's really interesting, you know. So rarely will you meet anyone so jealous as a teacher. So he's, and I've felt that. I've been a teacher, right? You know, where you felt that, you know, people are passing through, but there's joy. The joy is like you're helping these people along, right? And mm-hmm. and as soon as they get out there, when they succeed, that's always a joy. But here he's saying that there's a jealousy. You know, why can't I go succeed like that pupil did? And I can totally understand that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, teachers, I don't know if they were back then, you know, but they're paid less and all this other stuff. You know, it's just like you teach someone who makes, you know, double the money you do, and you say, oh, man, that life sounds pretty good. Fascinating. But yeah, the fact that it's like that sand, that's really something. And then he's like some deeply buried rock at the bottom of the current. He's like, that's him at the bottom of the sand pit. It's no different. Yeah. No different. Gosh, at all.
I didn't even think about that. And but
that's really great. Yeah. Was he saying this about the city as well? I think that there wasn't a single item of importance. Okay. And that was actually from the newspaper. So, but it was really about the city. So there was something going on there too. I mean, so if I back up, you know, he got people to give him a newspaper. So when he's in the bottom of the pit, he doesn't want to be there, right? And he's like, okay, well, I'm just going to leave. And then he learns slowly that they're not going to let him leave.
Which it took him forever to figure this out.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
He should have known this from the get-go.
He should have said, this is weird. I don't know if I want to go down there. But he wanted to stay overnight, right? That was his idea. I want to stay overnight and I want to live like the natives live. You know, like the insects, I guess. And now he is one.
Yeah.
I just find that it's just fascinating. And then he gets him to give him a newspaper. And then as he's looking at the newspaper, he realizes that there's no items of importance on there. He says there wasn't a single item of importance. A tower of illusion, all of it, made of illusory bricks and full of holes. If life were made up only of important things, it really would be a dangerous house of glass, scarcely to be handled carelessly. But everyday life was exactly like the headlines. And so everybody, knowing the meaninglessness of existence, sets the center of his compass at his own home. And love your home, right? So there's that.
Yeah.
And then just learning to love where you're at.
Yeah, maybe it's that, maybe in the end, the reason he stays is because what he's discovered is something more important, because it's a matter of survival. In the city, everything's kind of distant from you.
Yeah.
There is no survival instinct. But in the dunes, what he's discovering could mean the difference between life and death.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be without the threat of punishment. There's no joy in flight. You have to have that ultimate threat, maybe, in order for life to have purpose.
Yeah, I'm thinking through that. That's something. But yeah, the threat. Something is trying to connect and it's not quite connecting, which is like this whole thing, right? You know, I mentioned to you when I finished it, it was like, there's a lot here and it's not all quite coming together. And it could be that surrealist feel to it, because it was unsettling. I would say I was unsettled after I finished it. It was just an unsettled feeling. Nothing I could really put into words other than saying it was unsettling. But I could tell that there was a lot of things going on there. And me, in my Catholic brain, I was thinking purgatory is what into my head, you know? So here, you know, this could be a movie where suddenly he learns something at the end and then, was happily ever after. Right. I don't think that's what was here though. That's not what happened.
Yeah. So my Catholic brain thinks of it more in terms of, you know, the road to hell.
Uh-huh.
So like, it's just when he talked about the feeling of the sand clinging to him. And in the beginning, it's very, he notices it all the time and he thinks about it all the time. It's, to me, it was like sand was almost like sin. It clung to his body. He couldn't ever get it completely off. And if he did, it came right back to him because, of course, he's stuck down in the sand pit. He's surrounded by it.
Mm.
But then as he goes along, he gets more and more used to it to the point where he doesn't even want to escape in the end.
Wow. Yeah. That's cool. And then you have the ultimate joy of the bath that he gets to take occasionally.
Yes. And in that sense, he can only get clean with the help of the woman who gives him the bath.
Right. Or the help of the people who sent him the water.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. Someone from outside has to assist. That's something. Yeah, that's cool. But yeah, the stuff you're describing about the sand on their bodies and everything, that in the novel, that was amazing how he was describing that. And I don't know if I can think of another book where I've been so aware of two people's bodies as that. You know, I'm constantly reading about how there was sand everywhere and how they felt and how they were sweating. I don't know how many times it said that sweat flew from their pores or something like that. It seemed to be a line that was said, you know, four or five times, but it's like suddenly aware of the moisture in your body. It's like they're hyper aware of their physical selves, because of the damage being done by the sand.
Yeah. There's so many things I never thought about. What would happen if you lived in a place like this? Like, their eyes are always swollen because there's sand in them. They sleep with their faces covered because sand will fall on. Like, the rest of their bodies gets covered in sand. She says it's best to sleep naked because the sand will get trapped under your clothes and irritate your skin.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It gets in the water. It gets in the food.
Yeah.
I mean, they have to cover the table with an umbrella before they eat so that the sand doesn't fall through the roof into their food.
Yeah, it's everywhere. Yeah, and then all of this just sores on their bodies, sweat, him wanting a bath the moment he got there, and her saying that, well, you could have one the day after tomorrow. I mean, so just thirst was another one, just this constant thirst. And when there was a time when they said, okay, let's not... He wouldn't let her shovel because he was trying to figure out a way out, and they stopped sending water.
Yeah, and he drinks the sake.
right. He drinks the sake. And then the discovery of how – of this, like, water pump, you know, pump in quotes, where he's kind of figured out how to get water without them. And his reaction, I want to show them how that's done, is what he wants to do. Rather than keep it a secret, although it is a secret up to that at that time.
And it's insane that he wants to show these people that have trapped him in this pit. He wants to share this discovery with them. But I guess it shows he doesn't really intend to leave.
Yeah. And what does that really say? It's like, yeah. And then that's his excuse for not escaping, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because in the end, he says, like, I could do it.
Yeah. I could do it, but I really want to show them my pump. This pump is what he calls it. Yeah. And that's this rational self that he was at the beginning, you know, looking at the sand and describing it and all this stuff. And now, interesting. That's something else. There's another part that I highlighted, just this little section, and it does actually compare the students to sand, which is great. He says, the reason I brought up the example of sand was because in the final analysis, I rather think the world is like sand. The fundamental nature of sand is very difficult to grasp when you think of it in its stationary state. Sand not only flows, but this very flow is the sand. I'm sorry I can't express it better. And then she says, but I understand what you mean, because in practical education, you can't avoid getting involved in relativism, can you? No, that's not it. You yourself become sand. You see with the eyes of sand. Once you're dead, you don't have to worry about dying anymore. You must be an idealist. I think you must be afraid of your students, aren't you? I am, because I think my students are something like sand. The man laughed heartily, showing his white teeth, but not once had he appeared disturbed by the discordant exchange. And then he talks all the time about a Mobius circle, too.
Right? Yeah, that the guy's like a Mobius. They keep calling him the Mobius man.
Right, right. Which is, you know, that just means like things are repeating and there's a loop, right? It's just, it's
yeah, there's no front or back.
There's no front or back and there's no beginning or end. It's a never-ending thing. You know, you could walk on this circle forever, just mm-hmm. around and around and around and never be finished. So I mean, what is that saying? So the fundamental nature of sand is very difficult to grasp when you think of it in a stationary state. So sand not only flows, but this very flow is the sand. That's interesting, you know, so it's talking about time, you know, I'm thinking about an hourglass. And then, in practical education, you can't avoid getting involved in relativism. And then he talks about Mobius circles. So it's just like this, just like boom, you know. Again, I'm having trouble connecting everything into one thing.
Yeah, I remember reading that exchange a couple times.
Mm-hmm.
And just, I couldn't quite grasp what he was trying to say in that. And I think it's interesting that a lot of his descriptions of sand wind up sounding like water.
For sure.
Even though water is the one thing that he desperately wants more of through this whole book.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it's almost just like, I guess, the dead form of water, the way he talks about it. But, yeah, it's just...
And there's just a... It's a deep thirst, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's just... Yeah, so... I'm wondering now, I mean, if you aren't making all the connections and I'm not making any of the connections, maybe the author is doing something here where there is no connection, where he's like, the absurdist stuff is that this guy has a bunch of thoughts that he's not pulling together either. I mean, that could be something that he's doing here, is just showing you that maybe there's a pointlessness to his thoughts about all this stuff that he's trying to attach meaning to.
Yeah. And he's kind of interesting. I mean, cause that's all the flashbacks to his previous city life,
which seems
relatively meaningless. I mean, his relationship with the woman that he lives with, mm-hmm. his job that he hates. But he's kind of an interesting guy just because he shows up knowing stuff about sand and bugs that he's learned out of books. And when he's talking to the woman in the dunes the first time, he's telling her stuff. And she's like, well, that's not the way it works. You know, the sand mm-hmm. rots the boards of the house. And there's these insects that eat the wood of the house. And he's like, well, that's not true.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's like, well, how do you know? You learned this out of books. She's been living in this sand pit for who knows how long.
Right, right.
But he thinks that he knows, he always seems to think that he knows more than the villagers and the woman who've lived in these circumstances.
Oh, you're so right. You're so right. It's like, yeah, why don't they build a fence? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because, you're absolutely right. And what's that pointing to? It's like a city person's knowledge from books versus a poor person's knowledge from experience.
Yeah, this person, the poor person living from experience, is going to be the one who's right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So no matter how much money you spend on your education, it doesn't make any difference. And then that ties into him being a teacher, too.
Yeah, because he also puts an insane amount of confidence in, like, officials. So they talk about all the paperwork that's required just to live. And so I think when he's first trapped in the dunes, he keeps thinking, well, someone's going to notice I'm gone and they're going to come find me. Like, this can't just keep going this way.
Yeah.
Or somehow he's going to convince the villagers that he's too important to trap like this. But I mean, they're not thinking the same way. They live kind of almost outside of the governmental system he's used to, of the civilization of the city with all of its paperwork and, you know, the police and the people that can help you like that. Yeah, there's this dichotomy there of the way he thinks versus the way the villagers think, because he's living in a place where his survival is assured. And they're living in a place where they're having to scrape by their own wits. Because they're selling the sand. You know, it's funny. You feel bad for the woman up to a certain point. I mean, you feel like, oh, she's just been so accustomed to living this way that she doesn't realize there's another way. You feel bad for her. And then you find out that they're selling the sand. The sand is filled with salt, so it's not good for making concrete. But they're selling it to places to make concrete, who are buying it because it's cheaper.
Yeah, because it's kind of under the table, right?
Yeah, she doesn't care. She says, well, why should we care about them when they're not helping us? It's the most heartless thing the woman does in the whole book.
Right, right. It's their, that's not our problem. Yeah, that was a striking thing to me too, but I hadn't really connected it to anything else, but you're right.
Yeah, so it's almost like these poor villagers are striking out at the city people who are living, who are going to live in the concrete structures.
Yeah, and they're selling it for half price under the system.
Yeah.
Right. I felt like he was a mean guy, too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah. I don't know if that's a cultural thing or what, or if he's admirable in any way in a cultural way or not. But he was not a pleasant guy pretty much ever since the very beginning. You know, at the very beginning when he shows up, like you said, he was like, well, I know everything. And he laughs at her even. About, you know, what she said about if the sand gets on the boards disintegrate, you know. He says, nah, there's no way. So, and then he's physically abusive, right? And definitely emotionally abusive at various times. And I don't know. I mean, do you feel like that was cultural or... was he just lashing out, not knowing what else to do, or just did you forgive him that, I guess is my question. What are your thoughts on him?
Yeah, I think, well, and it's funny because Japan is a place where so much is, so much weight is put on politeness, and this guy's never polite.
True. Yeah.
So it could almost be worse there. I don't know the cultural nuances of it, but he's definitely unpleasant the whole time. And I think you can understand where he's coming from. Although for me, what was infuriating was that he always felt like he knew what would happen, like that his plans would work. Because he just had this, I don't even know where his confidence came from. This thing of like, well, I can get the villagers to let me go. I mean, maybe this is just because I've seen so many horror movies, but I'm like, why would they ever let you go alive?
Yeah, like, right.
You would destroy the whole system.
But yeah, very true.
So pretentious in a lot of ways.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you wonder if he was like that in his previous life or if this is his reaction. You know, could it be that he was very comfortable in his previous life and this is what would happen? If this had happened to him in the city somehow, you know, he would have the police, he would have a lot of options, right? But out here, he's got nothing, and he just didn't have an ability to deal with that or to see what was real in this surreal thing.
And he doesn't seem, we only see a few of his memories, but I would think his relationship with the woman from before doesn't make him seem like a great guy either.
Sure.
Neither of them seems to like each other very much.
Mm-hmm. Very true. Yep. Yeah. So he brings that with him.
Yeah, it's like he's living his life in the city just through inertia. Mm-hmm. He has this job as a teacher, so he keeps teaching. He lives with this woman, so he just keeps living with her.
I did feel like there was this thing going on, you know, if the city is like civilized, right? And then out here in the country, you know, we're more animals, right? mm-hmm. Dealing with just the basic needs.
I've always said that about you, Scott. All you small town dwellers.
That's right. That's it. We're just animal. Way more animal than civilized, for sure. Too funny. But at some point, I felt like there was a disintegration going on. And I don't know. I use that word disintegration, but I don't know if that's even the right word, because I don't know that it's a horrible thing. But again, it's this hyper attention to the physical person versus the civilized part of the person, right? Or you think that would be like the thoughts and the you know, Shakespeare and stuff, right? You know, this is civilization. We're all dealing, you know, with higher thoughts, and that's what civilization is supposed to be. And then you go to this place where all you're worried about are your basic needs. No matter how hard you work, what you're getting is your basic needs met. I guess what it's really showing you is that there really is no difference.
Well, yeah, because the woman lives like an animal in a lot of ways. What's most surprising about the woman is that she's okay with the man that's given to her, because the man treats her terribly, but she seems to like him no matter what. And it's almost like, you know, putting two animals of the same type in a cage in the zoo, because you need a male and a female. And she just accepts him because he is a man, even though he does nothing but cause trouble for a lot of the book for her. And I think that's never more clear than when he wants to go up to take a walk outside the pit. He's asking the villagers to let him up, and they won't. Well, they'll say, "We'll let you up if you, you know, have sex in front of us," essentially, because they're real classy out there.
Right, right.
And he is willing to do it. What's funny is she's actually not willing to do it. In that sense, he almost becomes more of an animal than she is in that moment.
Mm.
But reading that, I was like, oh my gosh, this is the scene most in the book that feels like two trapped animals in a cage. And that goes along with the bugs.
Mm-hmm.
And the villagers are just kind of using them for their labor.
Right.
Like we would use animals. And in the movie, that scene was crazy.
Yeah, it was. That went on and on.
With the masks and the drums.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and that you know, I see that, and I can, I'm guessing things were influenced by this movie. Other movies were, you know, rather than, you know, because I've seen other movies where, you know, that happened, that kind of stuff happens. Like The Wicker Man. I don't know if you've seen that.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that kind of stuff. You know, there's been a few where some kind of ritual is going on, and that's the kind of scenes that they show. These surreal memories of, you know, like what had happened the night before or something like that. It's something that I've seen several times, right? But here it is. This movie was 1964, I think. So I'm wondering if that's where that kind of stuff came from.
Yeah, so. Definitely could have.
But yeah, I like what you said about that was the closest we felt to two animals. And then later on, when she gets ill, and now they take her out of the pit because she needs medical care, that felt like animals in a cage to me too. You know, they pull her out, and he's no longer thinking about escape. His feelings when she's gone, you know, it's almost like a little bit of aimlessness, you know. Mm-hmm. But then he goes ahead and he climbs out and he goes to the ocean and he says, well, this isn't as cool as I thought it would be. You know, suddenly it doesn't have the appeal. The color wasn't right. Didn't smell the same as he thought it should. Mm-hmm. And then he just goes back down and then says, well, I can't wait to show people my pump, you know, this pump thing. But that felt almost like animals in a cage too. You know, you just have these two animals, one gets ill, you take it out and you go take it to the vet. Right. And then you put it back. That's what it felt like to me was happening. It was like a terrarium, mm-hmm. you know, you have two turtles or something. You take one yeah. out, you go to the vet, you bring it back. And, but yeah, that's not unlike what she was going through. She had family and they died and now she's got another one, right? That's what you do. Yeah. That's what you do if you had a couple of rabbits or a couple of rats or whatever they might be, you know?
Yeah, because she's sick because of her pregnancy. So they really are just breeding the next generation.
Yeah, right.
I mean, yeah, and that thing at the end where it's almost like now that he's has the option of leaving, he just doesn't want to anymore because he feels like he can whenever he wants.
And the author just leaves that so wide open, you know. I mean, we've talked about various interpretations of that, you know. So it could be that he's just learned to love the cell that he's in, right? What do you call that? There's a syndrome or something where you just... You start to like it, right?
Oh, Stockholm
syndrome. Yeah, right. So something like that? Or is it an actual realization that his life there isn't so bad? Is it just an accustomization to, well, I'm really kind of doing the same thing? You know, there would be no stress there. I mean, other than being in there, you know, you don't have the daily stress of having to make money to get food and to do all this and... What happens if I lose my job? You don't have any of that anymore. It's like it's being taken care of as long as you shovel this dirt, which I could do, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, really, in the beginning, I kind of forgot. In the beginning, what he's trying to do is discover a new beetle.
Right.
That's evolved to live in the sand. And he wants to almost make his mark on the world that way. So I wonder maybe if the satisfaction of having discovered this water pump, if that almost fills that need for him, if maybe he feels like he's been more useful here than he ever was in his other life.
Yeah. Yeah. And he said that that's what he wanted. He wanted his name in the book, right? He wanted a beetle in the book and with his name on it. And that was his goal. And then, yeah, so this has replaced that for him. And he's like, if this can be useful to these people of this town, he's done it. That's interesting, too. Man, there's a lot here.
Yeah,
there's just a lot here. You just keep picking at it, and it feels like that we've barely touched it so far. It's like we could keep going.
One of my favorite things is this thing about the radio. The woman wants to buy a radio. She wants to work extra to save up some money to buy one.
Mm-hmm.
And when he's talking, he's having one of his hypothetical conversations in his head, mm-hmm. like he does. And he's talking about somebody who left this town and went to the city to work. And they're speculating on what it would be. He says, well, after that, he probably got his pay on payday. And on Sundays, I suppose he put on a clean shirt and went to the movies. And then we'll never know unless we put the question directly to him, will we? And when he saved up some money, he probably bought himself a radio, didn't he? So it's that, you know, even if you escape the sand pit, your life is still the same. You live every day, you work every day, you do the same things every week. And then you save up some money and you buy yourself a radio.
Wow. And then mirrors too, right? When you said that, the thing that popped in my head was when he was talking about radios and mirrors. Mm-hmm. Because he was trying to escape, but he's attached to this woman now. And he was trying to justify, I can leave and leave her here. because the thing I highlighted says, by his disappearance, she would lose only a fragment of her life, one that could easily be replaced by a radio or a mirror.
Yes.
Right?
Like a bird.
Yes, exactly. So she says, you're really a great help. It's so different from when I was alone. I can take it easy in the mornings and the work is finished at least 2 hours sooner. I think I'll ask the village association to give me some kind of extra work. And that's what you're talking about for the radio. I'll save the money and someday I'll be able to buy a radio or a mirror or something, is what she says. And then he says, as if all human life could be expressed in those two things alone. Radios and mirrors do have a point in common. Both can connect one person with another. Maybe they reflect cravings that touch the core of our existence. All right. When he got home, he would buy a radio right away and send it to her. So he's justifying his escape, you know, and leaving her behind.
Yeah. And I love this thought that a mirror is equivalent to a radio. I mean, who are you connecting to in a mirror but yourself?
Right. Yeah. Well, I wonder what he's saying there. I mean, yeah. How is that? You know, how do you both can connect one person with another? Interesting. Because, yeah, how does that happen with a mirror?
Yeah.
Yep. I don't know.
And of course, why would you even need a mirror down there? You're just stuck with whoever you're stuck with.
Yeah. It says a mirror was different from a radio. For it to be a means of connection, she would first have to have somebody else there to see her. What use would a mirror be to someone who could no longer be seen? Yeah. So it's like a mirror is something you look at to prepare yourself to be seen by someone else. Maybe that's the connection. And then if you don't have someone else, what use is a mirror?
And of course, even if he escapes, they would just catch someone else down there. And I think that's also what's interesting about the way this town functions is their lifestyle isn't sustainable. But in order to keep it going, they're actually kidnapping people from other lives to do it.
Right.
I mean, that poor postcard salesman.
Yeah, no question. Yeah. And then at the very, very end, they've got those news clippings, you know, in the newspaper. I thought that was cool, too. I mean, it was really just well done. You know, here it is in the newspaper that he reads, you know, or wanted to read so bad. Yeah, I guess it doesn't really say that it's in the paper, but that's where I imagined it. But notification of missing person and this judgment declaring him missing. Yeah. Nikki Jumpei is hereby declared missing. Yep. Interesting. And
the person that filed the notice is his mother, and he never talks about his mother at all.
Mm-mm.
That's not interesting.
That is interesting.
It's not the woman he was living with. It's a woman he never thinks about.
Yeah.
Or worries about.
That's a good point. I don't remember ever saying anything about her.
Yeah.
Yep. And another interesting thing from this is that the book was written in 1962, and that's where it's saying that he's declared missing is October 5th, 1962. But it said that he disappeared in 1955. I'm not sure what the significance there is at all, but I mean, we had the war that ended in what, 45 or 46.
Mm-hmm.
So 10 years after that. And then there were other wars going on, in the 50s as well in the region, but not in Japan. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know that there's anything significant there or not, but he was writing in his past about, you know, 7 years in his past. And then again, maybe there's no significance to that at all, but, you know, so just the timing of where he said it.
Yeah. Cause one of the articles that gets mentioned in the paper, one of the headlines is something about onions curing radiation effects.
Mm, yeah.
It's just one of those reminders of, oh, this is the time and place.
Not long after.
In Japan, it probably wouldn't mean anything, but here it's just kind of startling.
Yes, for sure. Well, this is a fascinating book and movie. It's, you know, if we touch on the movie for a second, some of the things that were really successful there was like how the director did the physicality thing. with close-ups of sand on skin and things. That really worked for me. I mean, having watched the movie first, did that... I imagine you felt that. I mean, you kind of knew what was being said there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Seeing the close-ups of the woman's face and all that skin with sand all over it. I mean, yeah, you can just imagine it being on you. And then there was always kind of the howling of the wind in the background as more sand is getting blown on them.
Right, right. And you can see just that it flows. I mean, there were a couple of scenes where they showed, I mean, like a waterfall, just, you know, several waterfalls on a hill of sand just flowing down. What a fascinating book this is. My gosh. So you encountered this watching the movie. Were you in school at the time?
Yeah, I was in college.
That's amazing. Yeah. Yeah. And
I don't even know where I heard about the movie.
Hmm.
I may have just found it at the library, to be honest.
Oh, okay. You just kind of going through random films. Well, this was a lucky find. You lucky find. Well, I appreciate you bringing it here too. I never would have run across this. And it's definitely worthwhile. Definitely something to check out.
Yeah, it's an odd book.
Yeah.
And it's not too long. It's actually a pretty quick read. But it's, yeah, probably not something you want to do in one sitting.
No, no. Yeah, it is bleak. And it is thoughtful, both. So, yeah, very good. But I did enjoy it. I'm very happy to have read it. I did enjoy
it.
And it's something that's going to stick with me. You know, it's now in the file cabinets in my head. It's like, oh, this is just like when that guy was in the pit. You know, I can definitely see using this. So, well, thank you so much again for being on here and bringing this book. Thoroughly enjoyed it. So thank you.
Thanks for inviting me.
All right. Take care, everybody.